Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We bring you Bill Buford this time. Buford is a legendary editor who helped found Granta Magazine in 1979, and then went on to become the fiction editor of The New Yorker, a post he held from 1995 to 2002. He also edited three Granta anthologies. The author of several books of nonfiction, including Among the Thugs, a highly personal account of crowd violence and British soccer hooliganism, and Heat, about working behind the scenes in the kitchen of Babbo, the revolutionary Italian restaurant created and ruled by superstar chef Mario Batali. He is a staff writer and European correspondent for The New Yorker, where he has written on topics as varied as sweatshops, the singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams, the writer Christopher Hitchens, and of course, the great restaurants of the world and the people who run them. Join me for Bill Buford here on Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
I should begin properly by perhaps elaborating a bit more on Granta, what it is. I describe it sometimes as a highbrow Reader's Digest. Or literature for smart people. We sell about 100,000 copies. I mean, you've all been given an issue, and I urge you to dip in, read it, enjoy it. But mainly, I urge you to tear out the little card in the middle. Put your credit card number there. And if you're really smart, you'll notice that the issue you've got might be out of date, because I think the reason why we got these copies at such a discount is because they were sitting there in stock. But the advantage of that is that the subscription price will be the old one. This is our new issue, which you probably didn't receive, which is called Krauts. It's a leisurely, casual approach to Germany and nationalism. And is like, I knew we were off to a good start with this issue when a journalist from the Times sent a copy to the cultural correspondent of the Frankfurter Allgemeine, who said, when she took a look at the issue and read especially the blurb on the back cover, which I won't quote here, but urge you to read in your local bookshop, that if people keep talking about the Germans in this way, it'll turn out to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. And I think that's, well, it's obviously we're dealing with a delicate area, but there is an ambition in any literary editor, I think, to start a world war because of his cover of this magazine. The cover that really got Granta started was the one that we published 2 years ago. It was what educated me in the importance of covers, which is the special issue we did on the family. We had a piece from Michael Gilmore about his brother Gary Gilmore and what it was like to grow up with a lovely lad. Sappho Durrell, a very sad story about growing up with Lawrence Durrell, the novelist. And a very controversial story by William Wharton, an Oregon story, in fact, about the time when he lost his daughter, his son-in-law, his grandchildren in an accident that resulted from a stubble fire off the Interstate 5. And I had this idea for the cover, which drew from the Larkin quote. I'm going to forget the Larkin quote, and James Fenton's going to correct me and make a fool of me, but it's the one that's about the family, about they f*** you up, your mom and dad, they don't mean to, but they do, which is a very, very famous quote in Britain. And I had this idea. I had this idea of a cover which was very discreet, very understated, which was the family. They f*** you up. And worked on the cover. And, well, actually, I didn't work on the cover that much. I was in a great rush and finished the issue on a Friday night and then had to travel to America. In fact, I was traveling to America to see my mother and her husband. And I gave instructions to the designer to what I thought the cover should be, and he thought he'd experiment, and he didn't quite finish it before I left. It turns out my mother has a fax machine, and I thought, well, maybe he could send versions of the cover through the fax machine. I gave him the fax number. Unfortunately, they arrived. The fax arrived before I arrived. And what he'd done, he didn't follow the discreet, understated approach at all. What he'd done was sort of every possible experiment with, they f*** you up. So the first one they you up. And the next one was they fuck you up. My mother held this out to me and she said, Billy, did you have an unhappy childhood? The reason why I can't show you that issue tonight, though, is because it sold out so quickly, and the reprint sold out so quickly that I literally haven't got any more copies of it. Granta began in 1889. It's a magazine associated with Cambridge University, and is named after the river that goes through Cambridge. It's first called the Cam, and then it's called the Granta. I went to Cambridge in 1977 on a scholarship. Began quite honorably as an expert in Shakespeare's sonnets, and it went downhill from there. The magazine has a long history of being different things at different times. Sometimes it's like a school magazine. During the 50s, it became terribly pretentious and was publishing the poetry of Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath. At the end of the 60s, it was seized by the French structuralist craze, and an editor named McCabe, designed this lavish issue called Signs of the Times, devoted to French structuralism. Beautifully produced, beautiful paper, elegant printing, which the treasurer at the time could see there wasn't any possible way they could pay for. So he pocketed all the money in the treasury and went to Paris with his girlfriend. End of Granta. By the time I came to Cambridge, Granta kept changing its name slightly to avoid its creditors. Which is something we should probably start doing soon. And in fact, it was called Granta 77 to distinguish it from Granta 76 and to distinguish that from Granta 75. And it was a mimeograph thing, about 16 pages long with a staple in between it. And they rotated the editorship. The prospects of the future editors were quite limited by the time I got to Cambridge because the society publishing Granta consisted of Pete DiBala and me. And it was Pete DiBala's idea in the tradition of Signs of the Times to do an issue called The Theory of the Subject. And I much more mundanely suggested an issue called American Writing and had this idea that I would write all these American novelists that I was discovering in England for the first time. And I wrote 19 letters. I'm terrified of discovering what I wrote. And at some point, I'm going to look through the file and see what exactly I promised these writers. A little later, I will talk about the concept of the commissioning letter and how you create a piece of journalism. I have a feeling I promised quite a lot. I know there's some writers who are still very angry with me. In any case, of the 19 letters, we got 18 replies, and Granta was born. It's also the reason why we publish in this format, this paperback magazine format. It was a way of accommodating all the manuscripts that we got. Even so, there was something that made me a little uncomfortable about those early issues. This was 1979 when the first issue came out. I should mention that the first issue came out on a Thursday, and Pete and I took our exams for our degree on the Friday, and that gives some indication of how seriously I took my university career at that point. But this was the time when American writers were doing very experimental things. We did one story which ran down one column and had another story running down another column, which was to suggest the marvelous effects of the simultaneity of time. Compelling stuff. There was another story which was just all blank pages because this was the story in search of the author. Really compelling stuff. There was another story that was in 26 chapters, and chapter one was called A, and every word began with the letter A. Chapter two was called B. This was a very self-conscious literary project. This was literature with a capital L, and it made me distinctly uncomfortable. And I have to admit, I'm still uncomfortable with this idea of literature. I don't really know what it is. I have my own definition of what I regard as a literary piece of work, which is nothing more than a complex piece of writing that allows me to respond to it in a complex way. But actually, literature and the idea of doing a literary magazine, I mean, the idea of it, a literary magazine, it's the kind of thing that people who wear socks with their sandals do. I mean, you know, you see these perspiring people who are trying to get everybody to buy it, their mother, their sisters. They're sort of standing on street corners, buy some literature. I mean, what do you do with literature? You sort of phone up Martin Amis and say, I'll pay you X if you write a story of 5,000 words, but if you make it literature, I'll pay you double. It doesn't work. And then one day, I was lucky enough to be sent a manuscript of a novel by an unknown writer. And the novel was Midnight's Children, and the writer was Salman Rushdie. This would have been 1980. And it was like breathing oxygen for the first time. Here was somebody who was telling history, who was dealing with politics, who was dealing with stories, and it was invigorating and special, and we made it the first story in the issue of the magazine that we were putting into press then. I should mention that began a long relationship with Salman Rushdie, which continues to this day. And perhaps one of the best moments, if I could digress in a self-congratulatory parenthetical, was... The whole thing is really a self-congratulatory parenthetical, isn't it? In 1989, we began publishing books, and we published Salman Rushdie's Harun and the Sea of Stories. And to really appreciate the point of this, you have to understand that it's the aim of every editor at some point in his or her life to get arrested. I mean, that's really what you wanted. I mean, not arrested for taking off your clothes or something like that, but just to do something so dangerous that they have to put you away. It was always my fantasy that, and actually my mother's fantasy, that finally they would throw me out of the country and I'd come back. And we tried several times in 1985, and if I remember correctly, it was the very issue in which we were lucky enough to publish The Fall of Saigon by James Fenton. There was a little piece in the back about the sinking of the Belgrano. The Belgrano was a very controversial ship which began the Falklands War. And the British claimed that this ship, full of Argentine conscripts, was heading toward the Falklands Islands and was within the military exclusion zone that the British government had established and subsequently sunk it, and thus the war began. In fact, the evidence is very clear that it was not only was it not in the exclusion zone, but it was steaming in the other direction. And thus, it was an act of murder. Nobody had the evidence that it was steaming in the other direction. And one day, in a brown envelope, this manuscript arrived with the evidence. And I thought, oh, thank God, finally I get to get arrested. And I made a big mistake. I sent it to a lawyer. And I phoned up the lawyer the next day. Alan, it was his name. Alan, what'd you think? And he said, I think you've got to come to the office. I think you've got to come to the office right now because this violates the Official Secrets Act, and I think we have to turn it over to the government. This was such a traumatic experience. I had to go through this long, elaborate lie in which I brought down all my manuscript copies and we went to the shredder and we promised not to publish it, only to go on and then publish it. But in fact, there's been a number of stories in which lawyers get in the way. One of the most exciting was, because of the Official Secrets Act, we came across another manuscript by Anthony Cavendish, who was a member of MI5. He was a spy. And he had tried to publish his memoir, which was stopped by the British government. And the judge quite reasonably said to whoever it was representing the government, well, just what is it that you object to? Just go away and tell me what it is you object to. And he went away, and with a blue pencil, he marked through all the passages that violated the Official Secrets Act. And so the judge said, well, these passages cannot be published. So I had the bright idea that, because Grant is actually technically now published by two companies, Granta Publications Limited, which is a British company, and Granta USA, which is an American company, that we could do two editions. And we do one edition, which was had all the censored bits censored. And so the black pages would be blacked out, and the words, because it came down to little words, the words would be blacked out. And then in the American edition, we'd frame it with little passages saying, you cannot read this page in Britain. And little footnotes saying, you cannot read this word in Britain. And one would be published by the American company, and one would be published by the British company, and the British company had no idea how that American company got that manuscript. But by a mistake, a copy happened to pass through the office of someone in Penguin, London. Penguin distributes Granta now. And since he'd touched it, therefore, he was in the position where he could have stopped it. And therefore, the lawyers got involved again. And therefore, the edition we finally published was black everywhere. It was very depressing. You get these moments where finally you can get into trouble and you're stopped. And there's nothing depressing. They come once in a lifetime moment. This is a long self-congratulatory parenthesis. Such a moment happened actually with Salman Rushdie's Harun and the Sea of Stories, which was a book that was contracted to Knopf and Jonathan Cape. And everybody at the time was so terrified of publishing Salman Rushdie, because this was his first book after the Satanic Verses, that they panicked. Everybody was terrified of the man. Parts of Harun and the Sea of Stories was set in Kashmir, and the editor, a very famous editor, a very famous publisher, whose name will remain unknown to you, but his initials are, suggested perhaps that it should be set in Mongolia. The book was typeset under a pseudonym. It was never announced, and finally it got to be too much, and Salman Rushdie withdrew the book, and we published the book, and published it, I think, with a determination to diffuse all the tension and to publish it proudly and loudly and just disperse the fear. And it was a great moment. But I digress. I'm really here to talk about myself. That's not right. I'm really here to talk about journalism. We have the best of Granta Reportage, which is the best journalism that we've published in the magazine, which you cannot get, by the way, in America. But if you find that little card as a subscriber, the first issue of nonfiction we published was an issue of travel writing. It was Granta 10, which we published in 1983. And the way that issue came together was especially exciting. We have these editorial meetings where we try to sit around and think of a bright idea. And someone thought of the bright idea about travel writing, mentioned it to five or six people. And like all good ideas, suddenly there was this terrific momentum. And in something like 4 or 5 weeks, we suddenly had 10, 12 pieces and ideas for 10 more, and news that A was working on this and B was working on this, and there was this unknown fuzzy man who was named Redmond O'Hanlon, who had just journeyed to Borneo with James Fenton, and we should phone him, and he phoned him, and chapter 18 of this account arrived, and then chapter 12 arrived, and then chapter 19 arrived, and finally the book got done. But finally we had this issue of travel writing, and it was an extremely exciting thing. And what was exciting about it is that it was fiction, or rather, it was nonfiction written with all the form of fiction. It was an issue of narratives. And suddenly I became aware that in the area of nonfiction, especially in Britain, some of the best storytelling, that's where you're finding your best storytelling. And what was exciting about this nonfiction is that it consisted of writers who were going out into the world, finding something that we didn't know about, and coming back with a genuine story to tell us. I regard the Polish writer Ryszard Kapuściński in some ways as the best example of what this kind of travel writer is. Kapuscinski, who we've profiled in the magazine a number of times, he's written a number of excellent books. The Emperor, about the court of Haile Selassie, is one. The Shah of Shahs, about the fall of the Shah of Iran, is another. Described to me once what it was like to be the first Polish foreign correspondent in post-war Poland. And this was post-war Poland where the schools still didn't have windows, where people didn't have books, where they regarded Czechoslovakia as this foreign and exotic land where they would never go in their entire life. And he was dispatched to India and came back in sort of the most old-fashioned way to describe what it was like to see a tiger. And he was dispatched to China and came back in the same way that a Marco Polo would have returned to tell people what China looked like. And was there as the foreign correspondent in Africa and reported on 27 revolutions and coups, and was in the role of being the old-fashioned storyteller in the most traditional way. It leads to one of the first very elementary principles in getting a good piece of journalism, and that's getting there, getting to the spot, getting to the place. I think the most famous person in this regard is actually the other bald man to my left. Balding, it's a great distinction. Whose account of the fall of Saigon is one of the most exciting things we've published, and culminates, of course, in being at the wrong place at all the right times. I will never forget James Fenton's account of the looting of the U.S. Embassy and coming away with volumes 2 and 4 of Tom Jones. But it's always made me wonder who took volume 1 and 3. Or the fact that when the city finally fell, he was there on the tank riding into the presidential palace. And there was an extremely exciting moment when we got a phone call from James after the Marcoses had fled. And he was phoning to say that he had been, yes, once again at a presidential palace and had participated in the looting, this time coming away with Imelda Marcos's towel. There got to be a point, actually, where I'm sure James was refused visas for fear of what would happen when he arrived. One of our biggest scoops was an account of General Stroessner of Paraguay. Now, who's General Stroessner? Why is that such a scoop? And you have to recall that General Stroessner was the longest reigning dictator in this hemisphere, ruling Paraguay with terror and all the sort of pretty features of a fascist madman for 39 years. And then in 1988, suddenly fled. Everybody wanted an interview with this man. Everybody wanted an interview with this man. And nobody got an interview of him. Latin American journalists had heard that he was in Brasilia, and everybody was flooding to Brasilia. Nobody would get an interview. I think of this because I met this afternoon Joel Weinstein, who was asking me questions about Grant. And he said, what was it about, I mean, the thing that always struck me as curious about this account that you published by Isabel Hilton of General Stroessner was, how did you get the interview? And then I thought again about the commissioning letter. He had a tape recorder going, so I didn't really want to tell him, but I'll tell you on the condition that no one's got a tape recorder going. But there was this, I had this idea that here was Stroessner, and nobody got an interview with Stroessner. Here was an extremely talented journalist whom you probably don't know, but I think it's issue 37, if you look in the back for your back issue catalog, named Isabel Hilton. And the trick was to get her down to Paraguay and into South America to get the interview. So I wrote a letter. Dear Generalissimo, Jefe, Supremo, Stroessner. And mentioned the fact of Grant and its great distinguished history, going back to the 19th century. Suggested vague, not particularly articulated links to the University of Cambridge. mentioned our interest in a series, I really shouldn't be talking about this, of, you'll forget this, series of monographs on great Latin American leaders. Mentioned the dams in Paraguay, the electricity that the general, the supremo, the jefe introduced there, and his great achievements that have perhaps gone unrecognized. And was wondering if perhaps he might be the subject of one of our first monographs. Isabel Hilton got the interview. this business of getting there in journalism. I mean, we publish many other things besides journalism, but getting there is in many respects everything. And while I wouldn't want to put myself in the same ranking of the writers that we publish, I've certainly tried to take as many lessons from them as I can. And I have myself recently published a book about English soccer hooligans. This is the violence associated with that pleasant cultural pastime, English soccer, which you'll be able to see when the World Cup is hosted by the United States of America next year. I went to my first football match, as it's called in Britain, with two very distinguished people. I met these people at a literary party, and I was talking about the fact that I'd seen this football train in Wales. I was returning from Wales one Saturday evening, and this train had been taken over by football supporters. They were Liverpool supporters, and they were systematically taking the train apart. They were breaking up the tables, and they were smashing the windows, and police reinforcements were called in, and it was a terrifying and exciting experience for me. And I was mentioning this to Salman Rushdie and Mario Vargas Llosa, who took me to my first football match. Salman was very interested in the match, which apparently Tottenham Hotspur won. Mario Vargas Llosa was very interested in the songs, and none of them noticed that sort of they're all singing, that sort of the person next to me was urinating down the neck of the guy in front of him. And that the ones sort of three sort of down were sort of doing all these fascist chants. Principally the one that went wogs out, which was in response to Salman Rushdie. And it was probably good that he didn't notice it. And then later there was a fight, and the policeman came in and his helmet was taken off and thrown into the field. And I got terribly interested in this, and I thought just the business of going to a football game in Britain was an amazing thing. And I tried to commission someone to write about it for the magazine. And I couldn't persuade anyone to do it, so I decided I'd do it myself. And the trick, again, was meeting one of these people, one of these thugs, these hooligans. It was the business of getting there, and I didn't really know how to do it. I went to a Chelsea football match. Chelsea's one of the South London teams. And I sort of rustled my way into the crowd. And then I didn't know what to do. I mean, what does a hooligan look like? I suppose he looks pretty ugly. So I looked around for the ugliest people, and there was an ugly guy. But then I didn't know what to do. I said, you look awfully ugly. Can I be friends? And so I'd go to these matches, and I'd sort of look for these particularly ugly people and beam at them and smile, and it wasn't working. And I went, there was a match in Cambridge, and I went to the match in Cambridge and then found someone who was really, really ugly. And he turned out to be a member of the National Front. The National Front is the neo-fascist league in Cambridge. And I thought I would read you just a little passage about how I finally made my contact with an English football hooligan, just as an example of the experience of getting there. This was Manchester United had a reputation for having particularly violent supporters. They were banned from Europe. And quite a distinction at the time. I mean, later, England supporters were banned from everywhere. But at the time, it was quite a distinction to be banned from Europe. And I wanted to go to one of their matches to find out why they were banned. But again, I had this problem of wanting to meet one of them. I mean, just how do you meet one? So I took a train. I took a train from London to Manchester. And it was the train itself, these football trains. Oh, how to explain this? They're not like The English male is an extraordinary phenomenon. They're not these when they all get together and go to football matches. They're not like anything you would see here. Well, this train, for instance, it was the familiar sight of people packed into the seats, on the floor, suspended from the luggage racks, playing cards, rolling dice, drinking unimaginable quantities of alcohol, steadily sinking consciousness into a blurry stupor. I walked from carriage to carriage looking for one of them, and came across someone who was truly spectacular to look at, qualifying for that special category of human being, one of its most repellent specimens. He had a fat, flat, bulldog face and was extremely large. His t-shirt had inched its way up his belly and was discolored by something sticky and dark. The belly itself was a tub of sorts, swirling, I would discover, with liters and liters of lager, partly chewed chunks of fried potato, and moist, undigested balls of overprocessed carbohydrate. His arms, puffy, doughy things, were stained with tattoos. On his right bicep was an image of the Red Devils, the logo of the Manchester United team, on his forearm, a Union Jack. When I came upon him, he had just tossed an empty beer can into the overhead luggage rack. Quite a few were there already, and had started in on a bottle of Tesco's vodka. I introduced myself. I was writing about football supporters. Did he mind if I asked him some questions? He stared at me. Then he said, "All Americans are wankers." You probably don't, wankers. I'll explain later. And paused. "All journalists," he added, showing perhaps that his mind did not work along strictly nationalist lines, "are c***s." We had established a rapport. His name was Mick, and on arriving in Manchester, he rushed me across the street to a nearby pub for 3 pints of beer, drunk with considerable speed. I accompanied Mick to the match, where he led me to the Stretford Inn, the standing room section of Old Trafford, packed, enclosed, so that the chance, showing an impressive command of history and linguistic dexterity, I should mention, they're playing an Italian team. They're playing Juventus of Turin, which explains the chants, which I'm about to cite. One was, "Where were you in World War II? The other was, "Fa fanculo," which I'm told is f*** off in Italian. Was so amplified that it was hours before my ears stopped ringing. As I fell asleep that night, I found myself relentlessly repeating the not especially somniferous slogan that Mussolini was a wanker. I'm probably going to have to explain this term wanker. At halftime, Mick rushed off again for refreshment, which this time included 2 meat pies, a cheeseburger, and a plastic cup of something. I couldn't touch it, and not losing a minute, Mick, waste not, want not, drank mine as well. At the end of the match, Mick grabbed me by my sleeve, tugged me through the crowd, ushered me down the Warwick Road North, a quick stop for 2 orders of fish and chips, grease pouring through the newspapers, Mick's t-shirt by now a work of art, and then across the street into the pub, where after 3 quick rounds at the bar, Mick bought a further 2 pints before sitting down with me at the table. I was the one who asked that we sit. I was starting to bloat. I just mentioned one other thing about Mick, which is that in Britain, they stop drinking at 11 o'clock, and it was this, and at 11 o'clock they call time, and never, ever have I heard time spoken with such grace and beauty as when the bartender finally said time, and I could stop pretending to be drinking pint after pint with Mick, who by that time had was really quite disappointed in me because he felt that I wasn't drinking. I'd had 8 imperial pints of beer by then. It was 11 o'clock, someone was calling time, and I calculated that in addition to an order of fish and chips and a thoroughly indigestible cheeseburger, I had had 2 cans of lager and 8 pints of bitter. That was a lot, I thought. I had done rather well, I thought. But Mick was now telling me that I wasn't much of a drinker. Mick certainly was. He was not keeping track of what he consumed, but I was so impressed that I was. In addition to a newspaper full of fish and chips, his 2 cheeseburgers, his 2 meat pies, his 4 bags of bacon-flavored crisps, and the Indian takeaway that he was about to purchase on his way to the station, Mick had had the following: 4 cans of Harp Lager, a large part of a bottle of Tesco's vodka, and 18 pints of bitter. As the pub closed, Mick bought a further 4 cans of lager for the train ride home. This is not unrelated, by the way, to my own theory of note-taking, which is the bladder theory of note-taking. One of the tasks I faced with mixing with these thugs, which I did for far too long, 6 years, in fact, was, while I was very happy to tell them what I was doing, that I was writing a book about them, they didn't believe me, neither did my publisher after 6 years. I didn't want to show clumsily that I was a journalist. I didn't pull out a tape recorder and say, you know, tell me about life. And I didn't pull out my notes, but I had to record their conversations and their thoughts. And the system I developed, and I believe it's unique, this bladder theory of note-taking, was that I would attach a phrase. I mean, they'd be telling me something like, you know, and then I, you know, punched him in the nose and headbutted him, and sort of headbutt, stick that, and I'd sort of attach headbutt to that finger, and then they'd tell me something else. I mean, there was their names or something like that, and I'd sort of put that on another finger, and then they'd talk about something else, and I'd put that on that finger, and then until finally I had so many conversations on these fingers that I had to go to the, well, what I would now call the loo, I suppose, but what I'd have to go to the bathroom, and then I'd shut myself into the stall, and I'd pull out my notepad out of my back pocket, and I'd say, right, that's that finger, and I'd write that down, and that's that finger, and I'd write that one down, but it got to be such a problem, especially when you're sort of in sort of big, important days, that I finally had to own up and say I had stomach problems, and I kept going back and forth to fill up all my notes. Part of the reason why I cite my own book is because this is, as I said, a long parenthetical of self-congratulations, but was to illustrate that what I try to look for, I think what I've come to realize is that what I like to see in a piece of journalism, in an ideal world, is sort of journalism of extremes, journalism of passion, journalism that's going to take me to some place where I haven't been before. In an ideal world, an account of the world that confuses me, that confuses easy categories of right and wrong, or easy categories of how I make sense of the world. One of the best examples, and I think an example both of how journalism can be bad and how it can be good, is an account by John Simpson of the events in Tiananmen Square. I noticed there were copies of our birthday issue. After Grant had published for 10 years, we did a birthday special, and there's an account there, and also it's in here in the Best of Grant to Travel, of John Simpson's account of Tiananmen Square. John Simpson is a BBC reporter and was covering the democracy movement in Tiananmen Square and was filing excellent reports. He was there on the night when the soldiers came in and killed the people. And it was a very traumatic experience for him. And when he returned, I met and we talked about it, and he said he wanted to write a story for the magazine, and I wanted a story very badly. And he wrote a story for the magazine. But it wasn't very good. It was very long, but it was obvious. It was everything that we knew. There was nothing surprising. It wasn't following the basic principle of any storytelling, which is to tease, to manipulate, to surprise, to confuse, to tell us a story. But in passing, he mentioned that there was one traumatic moment, and this was the moments before the trouble started. And they'd actually filmed this, but they never showed it because they were so upset by what they saw that they didn't broadcast it. And this was actually where the story began. And this was the report that should have been on the news but never was. Later, I saw the rushes, and the rushes from what they shot that night were terrific and very disturbing. And it was an occasion of editorial intervention of a sort, in which I had these 45 pages by him, and I told him to throw the 45 pages away and write about this paragraph. This paragraph was where he mentioned in passing that a tank had got caught early on in the evening, which had gone out and had got caught up in the barricades that the students had erected, and had been surrounded by students who had systematically pulled out the soldiers inside and killed them with their hands. And John Simpson had saved one of them from being killed, one of the soldiers from being killed. And he wrote up this account. In fact, it was a 20-page account of this very confusing event where the people who are in favor of democracy are behaving in a very dangerous and disturbing way. And it raises all kinds of questions that he can't answer and I still can't answer. But it was a very powerful eyewitness piece of journalism. I will finish with this principle of eyewitness journalism. And it's only one kind of journalism. It's not the only kind of journalism I like. It's not the only kind of journalism we publish. But it establishes the principle that if you're doing this kind of journalism, or at least what I always thought was the principle if you're doing this kind of journalism, is that if you go to all the trouble of getting there, if you go out of all the trouble of getting into the embassy that they're looting, or spending too much time with the drunken Mick, the thing you don't want to do is leave. At least that's what I always thought. And I'd like to finish with a little episode that Ian McEwan seems to enjoy so much, which was at the end of the World Cup in Italy in 1990. I went to the World Cup in Italy in 1990, which was the end of my book. It was the end of my research. I went very reluctantly. I didn't want to go. I'd had enough of the mix. To be honest, I'd had far too much beer, and I was getting very, very fat, as opposed to just very fat. But I went reluctantly because England was playing Holland. Now, England is known for its very violent supporters, and the Dutch are known for their very violent supporters. And there was bound to be a lot of violence. England was playing Holland. For weeks, there was something in the press every single day, sometimes two and three articles in the same paper about the day when England was playing Holland. And it was obviously something I couldn't miss. So I went to the island of Sardinia, where England was playing Holland in one of the first matches of the World Cup. And there was so much bad press about how the English supporters were going to behave that there were only 4,000 of them there. Put this in context, there were 7,000 police. And there were so many members of the press to watch this day when England played Holland and everybody behaved violently that they had press conferences three times a day leading up to the match when England played Holland. And so I went. And sure enough, there was trouble. But there wasn't trouble with the England supporters and the Dutch supporters. It was trouble with the England supporters and the Italian police. Everyone had got so excited that they just beat each other up. And this went on for a very, very long time as 1,000 England supporters ran through the streets of Sardinia behaving like complete idiots. And the Italian police ran after them behaving like complete idiots. They were shooting guns and it was a preposterous thing. Until finally, the Italian police retreated and disappeared. And this was an extraordinary thing. You've got 7,000 members of the press. You've got the most hyped event in sporting history. And then suddenly, the Italian police disappear. The England supporters, being very stupid, thought the Italian police had disappeared because they'd been beaten. And for the first time that day, they all started chanting, "England, England," as if they were a rival football team and they defeated them. I didn't think this was going to happen. And I got quite nervous. I didn't think the Italian police were just going to go home as these England supporters were going to go to the football match and have a nice time. I just didn't think that was going to happen. I was just waiting for the retaliation. Just any moment now, I knew it was going to start. And sure enough, out of nowhere, it began. Hundreds of canisters of tear gas started falling. I didn't know where they were coming from, but suddenly they all started coming down. And I was waiting for this moment. And the moment they started, I sprinted. I ran fast. I ran faster. I ran so fast, I was right up there at the front of the crowd. I just sprinted up this hill. No one was going to stop me. I wasn't going to get caught. There were all those police behind me, and they weren't going to get me. I just ran right up to the top. Got up to the top of the hill. Canisters of tear gas behind me. Italian police behind me. Got rid of them. Just over the crest. And who do I see but 2,000 police waiting for the people as they come over the top of the hill. Oh, that was so depressing. They were there. The police were behind. There were no side streets. I was the first one over the top of the hill. They thought I was the leader. I look to the left, there's no escape. I look to the right, there's no escape. I go forward, I get killed. I go backwards, I get killed. I wish I could, how I wanted to be able to fly. So I did a very brave thing. I got on my hands and knees and I covered my head. and hid between two cars. And everything went in slow motion. I thought, you know, they won't touch me. There's all these other, by that time, there's all these other England supporters coming over the crest of the hill. They're the ones who are going to get zapped. I thought, no, I'll be safe. They won't touch me. I mean, after all, it's like waving the white flag. I mean, I was the only one on my hands and knees. I noticed three things the first time I was hit. One was the effort to ensure that I was hit powerfully. My head was down, but I could tell that the policeman, rather than smacking me once on his way to the other supporters, had come to a complete stop. I could see his boots. He then pulled back his truncheon and paused, aiming his blow. I thought, he won't do it. And then I thought, okay, so I was wrong. Second, the target. It was my kidney. The policeman, I infer, had sized up the situation. Fat man on the ground, curled into a ball, the obvious target. That was where he could do the greatest damage. Third, I noticed that the blow did not sting. It hurt. It sent a sharp impulse of energy like an electric thread from the point of impact straight to my stomach. There was a fourth thing. The policeman did not leave. He hit me again. This, I admit, surprised me. I thought I had fooled them. Then he hit me again. This inevitably surprised me less. Then he hit me again. This was no surprise at all. By the time he had hit me five times, I realized that he was not going to leave. He was going to stand over me, taking his time, lifting his truncheon, aiming it, and then smashing my kidney. Each blow went to the same spot, the kidney, and each one I found hurt just as much as the one that came before it. There was a fifth thing. Not only was this policeman not going to leave, but he was going to be joined by a colleague. This did not make sense. Why waste another policeman on me when there's so many other people still to beat up? But the temptation must have been too great. Here on the ground, showing little resistance, was a perfectly adequate specimen, even if a bit fat. He couldn't pass it up. The second policeman went for my head. And he was joined eventually by a third policeman. And they had a great deal of fun. And it hurt. All of this was exceptionally painful, as would be expected, but my experience of it was different from that of the others who were being beaten up. Their experience was one of simple pain. For me, it was more complicated, because I knew that I would be writing about it. While being beaten up, I was thinking about what it was like being beaten up. I was trying to retain the details, knowing that I would need them later. I thought, for instance, that this experience was not so different from one I had witnessed in Turin several years before, which is also earlier in the book. I thought of the fact that I could even think of this coincidence and marveled at the human mind's capacity to accommodate so many different things at once. And I thought about that, the fact that while being beaten up, I could think about the human mind's capacity to accommodate so many different things at once. I thought about the expenses I had incurred and was grateful that I was going to get something out of this trip after all. But mainly I was thinking about the pain. It was unlike anything I had known, and I wanted to remember it. Thank you.
You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. That was Bill Buford. He spoke at Portland Arts and Lectures in 1993. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project, a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Liguori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.